2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
There's desperation and anguish.
More than 80,000 Afghans have since arrived in America, but this story is still unfolding. I'm Andreas Martin. In my new podcast, Stranger Becomes Neighbor, we'll find out what happens to these new arrivals in our communities. Who would help our newest neighbors? Follow us at kslpodcast.com, Apple Podcasts, or anywhere else you listen.
Hey, welcome to Project Recovery, a podcast about addiction, but more importantly, about recovery. And it's brought to you by useonlyasdirected.org. They've got a three-part solution: speak out, opt out, and of course, throw out. And make sure you talk to your doctor, and we want to thank them for all their help. Dr. Matt, how are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
Big show today. Lemma Harrington, we're going to get to him in just a second. But I wanted to talk to you real quick because you came in, you're kind of disheveled, but your hair was blown back. You got the motorcycle out.
Yeah. Riding the bike today.
So
first day out.
What made you want to do that?
Ride the bike?
Yeah.
Oh, see, if you've been on a motorcycle, you don't ever have to ask that question because it's just, it is such a wonderful freeing experience to get on two wheels and just cruise a little bit. I can't say that I'm a big biker. I don't go to, you know, the big conventions and all of that, but I love getting out and riding my Honda around. It's a lot of fun.
Do you have a shirt that says, if you can read this, my girlfriend fell off?
No, but I think I'll get one.
Right?
My girlfriend doesn't want to ride with me, so it would always be applicable, you know.
Hey, I'm glad we got a Lemmy here today, and we're going to talk to him in just a second. But I was thinking to myself as I was driving down here. I mean, you know, with all the stuff that's going on right now with COVID, job insecurity, housing, and so much, which seems to be a lot for normies, as we call people who don't have addictions, to deal with. Could you imagine what it's like right now somebody who's also battling an addiction or a family member?
Well, we know that the relapses are up around the country. Substance abuse in general is up. You know, people are turning to what they know, which are some bad habits, to kind of deal with that stress and anxiety. And it's a really tough gig right now to stay sober. So we're happy to be here and highlight some options and ways to help people stay sober during this time.
Now, a lot of industries and a lot of businesses are actually down right now. But you said the mental health field is really having an
increase. Busy. Yeah, it really is. And I think that's kind of, we've talked about in past shows that maybe the next pandemic's going to be kind of a mental health pandemic. How do we as a world adjust to changes in how we work, how we go to school? You know, I talk to parents whose little kids are having meltdowns with all the stress and pressure trying to figure out how to get their schoolwork done online, up to parents who have maybe lost a job or now they're underemployed and they're trying to figure out how to support their family. Many people reaching out to us on Facebook about their stresses with trying to stay sober or deal with an addiction, substance abuse. Am I addicted? Am I not? But people, I mean, as a joke, people are saying, oh, you can start drinking at 10 a.m. now, you know, and it's like, no, that's not, you don't get a free pass. It's not healthy. But I get that. I get that. The stress and the boredom, right? That's another thing. Not being able, all the introverts are ruling the world, but the rest of us that are a little more extroverted and we're not out seeing our buddies and, you know, shaking hands and doing all that stuff that makes us feel connected. You have to find alternative ways to feel connected. Otherwise, you sort of collapse in on yourself, and substance abuse can become part of that.
And Project Recovery wants to be a resource for you. Of course, you can hit us up on all our social pages. You can email us. And if there's anything we can do, we'd love to be able to help you out. But what we can do is give you another great episode. And today, we're super stoked. Lemma Harrington, how are you, sir?
I'm doing so good.
And I've been trying to...
My mom would say, you're doing well. You're not doing good. So let me correct my... I'm doing well.
Right.
I'm doing well. And I love the intro, Matt, that Dr. Matt, that you just gave, and some insight as to, you know, what we're dealing with. Because as you talked about, Casey, there's normies out there struggling with this. And for us that are in that world of addiction and dealing with that, you know, you add that layer on top of it. And it becomes a struggle. And it is that. So
it's a perfect storm.
I think some people who are in recovery might actually have a little advantage right now, because the normies who have never drank every day and done those sorts of things, you know, that they're starting down a path that could be very destructive. So if you have a little bit of time of sobriety under your belt, maybe it's an advantage. I don't know.
Yeah.
Hey, I want to start out by saying, because you probably get this a lot. I got it quite a bit when I was first into the recovery world as Alema Harrington. How did that happen to him? I mean, he was a superstar in football, a graduate, a TV guy. How did this happen to you?
Not you.
That doesn't happen to people like you. But then I want to go back and go, really? Let's go Jack, you know, you know, all the celebrities, Ben Affleck. I mean, but addiction does not discriminate.
No, it doesn't. And I was one of those guys that got a, you know, I guess in some cases, because I work as a substance use disorder counselor now, so I see all kinds of different clients and cases that come my way. And a lot of people start very early, like 13, 14 years old, right?
I was one of them.
And I wasn't in that category. I was the guy that grew, you know, born and raised in Hawaii and was one of the few, you know, LDS population is smaller, still large, but it's smaller there. And so you're kind of a little bit different and people know, like, oh, that's the Mormon kid and that kind of thing.
He can't play on Sundays.
Right, yeah. And can't play on Sundays. And so, you know, I experimented a little bit in my high school days, but not really anything that was, you know, over the top. I didn't really like weed when I first tried it, and alcohol, you know, tasted terrible. And so it wasn't until my senior year in high school that I started to kind of do that senior party thing a little bit, and I you know, found that I kind of like this and the social ease that I have. Because in spite of being, you know, a somewhat popular person, I still had this social anxiety, right? And then the alcohol, man, beer really helped that a lot. And so then I ended up at BYU, and I thought, well, I'll go to BYU. Nobody drinks there. And nobody does drugs there. And,
former BYU grad.
And we laugh because we know the reality of their, you know, it's to just some degree, there's like an entire underground, or at least when I was there in the 80s, right?
Yeah.
There's this entire underground movement that is rebelling against, right, the what would be considered LDS social norms.
Like a counterculture. Right.
Didn't Jim McMahon go to BYU?
Yes, he did. In fact, it's funny because my father, who was an entertainer in Hawaii and had a show in Hawaii for many years. He befriended Jim McMahon when Jim had just gone to the Bears, had been drafted. And so when Jim McMahon found out that my brother and I had committed to BYU, he was on his honeymoon in Hawaii. And so he tells my dad, tell the boys to come over and visit with me. So we go over to this really plush hotel, and he's in there. He's got a cooler with beer in it in his hotel, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, he's kicked back and he tells us these stories about his experience at BYU and how, you know, people didn't understand him and they were kind of jerks to him. He was the Catholic kid from Roy. And so we got kind of a, you know, a preview of what that might end up looking like. But even for me going to BYU, I didn't consider myself a partier. I remember being on my recruiting trip at BYU and there were guys that were partying and I wasn't part of that group at that time. And so it wasn't until, like, you know, I started at, you know, going to school at BYU, and the first time that I was prescribed a narcotic, an opiate, was at BYU. And I had plenty of injuries as a high school football player and athlete, but never once had I been prescribed an opiate. And so I remember being in John Hall at Helaman Halls and coming back from the training room after practice with a little manila envelope that had my medications in it. At that time, you'd go see the doctor. If you had an injury during practice, then they say, okay, go see the trainer after practice, and then you might end up going to the doctor. You go to the doctor. And at that time, we had a pharmacy that was inside the locker room. So where the locker room was and the doctor's office was in the training room, you would go see the doctor, they would give you a prescription, or they would just let the pharmacist know. You'd walk over to the next door over, and that was the pharmacy. And they would give you your medication for the day. And it wasn't always narcotics. I mean, I want to be clear that it wasn't like that. So that's where you got all your dope. But that was the first time I was prescribed, and I had I was given Percocet and Soma. For those who don't know what Percocet is, an opiate, Soma is a pretty powerful muscle relaxer. I'm not sure, Doc, is it in the benzodiazepine category?
I think it is a benzo, yeah.
It's pretty, you know, it's in,
it has
you know,
addiction
it's potential, there with
yeah,
Valium, yeah. At least in my opinion, Valium along with Xanax and it's in that category. So one of the other players, older players that was experienced, told me, you know, take one of these, take two of these. And I remember I took those, and I remember when it hit my bloodstream, it was like one of those moments where
an aha moment.
It was a life changing moment for me. Because you got to consider that I'm at BYU as, you know, coming from Hawaii as this star football player, and now I'm at BYU and everybody's a star football player, and I'm buried on the depth chart. I'm not getting any reps in practice, and I'm feeling like really less than, not good enough, right? Which just accentuates all of these other inner feelings that you know, maybe at some point might have been a little bit latent because I was, you know, being successful in sports. But all of a sudden, I'm just really feeling that. And when those drugs hit my system, and it just made me feel like I'm okay. Mm-hmm. And for me, I realized today, looking back on that moment, that was problematic. That was a problem, you know, because it wasn't about the physical pain for me. It was how it relieved my emotional pain. And so it's, you know, that's where it started for me. And then when you're a kid, that
feels good, right?
Like, oh, yeah.
Like when you're a kid, all of a sudden you found relief for that tension that you're just living with all the time. And when you're there, you're starting over. Like a lot of people this fall are going to try to figure out college, whether you're playing sports or not. And you might have been something in high school, but now it's like a reset.
Yeah.
But he's an athlete. He's been told to play through pain.
Play through the pain. But like what – so I redshirted at BYU kicking. And to say I played was much overstated.
Yeah, I didn't overstate mine too.
That's okay. Yeah. No, you don't. I do. But like you get there and all of a sudden you're nobody. You have to start from zero, right? And so even if physically you're doing well, you don't know that the coaches are even looking at you. You feel like nobody's looking at me. Mm-hmm. And so that tension, that anxiety, and it is problematic, but when you're a kid, it's magical.
Yeah.
You don't know that it's a problem.
Yeah, because we talk about, you know, now as a counselor, you know, I'm able to recognize that the drugs were not a problem for me. Drugs were my solution, right? Mm-hmm. And so that was the solution to my social anxiety. That was the solution to me feeling less than, not good enough.
Builds a it's like a false confidence.
Absolutely. And for me, and especially at that time in my life, man, it was probably, you know, you could even look back down and say that might have been life-saving for you. That, you know, you had that because you get into a deep depression. Maybe I would have dropped out of school or something. But anyway, that's where it started for me. And then it was, you know, when I got injured or when somebody else had some pills or whatever. And then I started drinking, too, my freshman year at BYU. And it was a different world back then. And I found that, you know, so a beer with some pills, man, that was amazing. You know, the feeling of euphoria that I would get from that. And so it continued, and eventually, by the time, you know, I get to my senior season at BYU, it has spiraled completely out of control. And somehow I graduated. I have two back surgeries along the way. And for me, once, you know, I get into that chronic back pain, it's almost like, you know, what else am I going to do? It's like my football career was marginal at best at that point, and I didn't have any hope that it was going to be what I had dreamed it was going to be.
NFL or anything
like
that. Yeah,
so it's like at that point, it's just like, you know, I kind of embraced this party scene kind of guy. And I was in Lavelle Edwards' office, you know, pretty often for, you know, getting in trouble and being put on double secret probation and be up at the standards office on the seventh floor. And so I was very familiar with what that was about. And the wild thing for most of us that end up in that spot, it's like I never imagined that that's how it was going to go for me. And eventually it did. In the end of my senior season at BYU, I had picked up my scholarship a year late because of the missions at that time had gone from 2 years to a year and a half. A bunch of guys came back. They held my scholarship till my sophomore season. And so I was done playing, but I was still on scholarship. And I'd had my second back surgery and was in a lot of pain. and was used, doctor shopping, multiple doctors, and doing everything that I could to stay high all the time because that's felt good. And I had gotten a prescription and forged the prescription for the refills, which at that time you could sometimes alter. They're much more obviously careful about the way that prescriptions get passed today. But back then you could get away with some things, and I thought I was getting away with something. I gave went to a pharmacy to fill the prescription, and the pharmacist looked at the prescription, and he said, hang on a second. And as soon as he said that, I got scared, and so I left. And I remember I called our trainer at BYU. His name was George Curtis. You probably remember George.
Yeah.
Good guy. Really good guy. And I said, George, I need some help. I think I have a pain management problem. Right? I didn't even consider that I might have an addiction, right, that I, had the disease of addiction. I had a pain management problem because what was happening was I hadn't managed this properly. So let me figure out. So he was able to get me into treatment. And really what I was doing, I was running from, I thought the DEA was going to, that was during the days of the battle ram. And, I thought they were going to come break down my door, which wasn't reality, but it scared me into treatment. And I went to a treatment facility for the first time in, I want to say this was like 89 or 90 was the first time I went to treatment. I've been to treatment, close to 10 times now. And so that first trip in treatment, I still remember going there thinking, well, I'm just going to see what this is like, and maybe I can learn something about how to manage my pain.
And exploratory.
Right. And I remember being there. It was a 28-day program. I remember being in there. I tell this story sometimes. I was there, and I was in a group setting, which you're familiar with, Casey, and you're sitting in that circle of the group. And
everybody's
sharing, right? We're sharing our stories. And this lady is telling her story. And she's saying, and I was using 30 pills a day between the Valium and the pain pills. And I remember thinking, holy, this chick is sick, right? I'm like, man, it's a good thing you're here because you are really sick. And not realizing, because at that time I might use maybe 12 Percocet a day or something like that. I didn't realize.
Still a ton of Percocet.
Right, by the time I was done, tolerance was so. I was using 100 Lortab 5s a day. Right. And just the acetaminophen in that is enough to,
That's
kill your
wreck
liver.
Your kidneys and,
and so I had no idea my first trip to treatment that how progressive this disease was. Right. Yeah. I'm looking at this lady like, man, you are really sick, having no idea that if that's the gauge of your illness, then I would be end up way sicker than that. So anyway, I go through treatment. I didn't finally get sober until my fifth time through treatment. And I lost a family along the way, a wife and three kids. And, we can explore more of the parts of that story. But, the bottom line is when it came to a head for me, I had been sober for 8 years. I was working here at Channel 5. Myself, Craig Bowler, Jack, Sports Beat Saturday and Sports Beat Sunday was some good years.
In fact, I was working here. I was a camera guy.
As we're reliving this Last Dance with Michael Jordan, and Bowler and I actually just did a Ghost Cast last night. Ghost Cast, check it out on the Apple Store app. But as we did that last night, reflecting on what an amazing time for sports that was, right?
And
we were
for
just
Utah.
Riding the crest. Right. BYU goes to the Cotton Bowl, and, University of Utah basketball was in the Final Four in the championship game. And we are just living the dream. 2002, the Olympics come here. But something happened. Craig Bowlerjack left Channel 5. And the assumption, at least for me, was, OK, they're going to promote me to the weekday sports anchor.
You're the heir apparent.
Right. I'm the heir apparent. That didn't happen. And they say in recovery, that resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. And for me, I picked up a resentment, right, towards the person they hired instead of me, which was Tom Kirkland, pretty open about that now. Tom Kirkland, the station, people in general, God, it's like this is not fair. And it was at that point that I started to slip in what I thought I had as my recovery. and slowly but surely we went into a complete spiral till in 2002, Channel 5, after the Olympics, did not renew my contract. That was at the end of a second three-year contract at Channel 5. They did not renew my contract, and I was just, you know, I was out on my own, and they were still paying my contract. They said, you know what, this is how bad it was. They're like, we're going to let you go, even though you're not done till August. You got 3 months left on your contract, but you can leave now. And the crazy thing, you know, is that there was never anything said about my drug use. And I was having, you know, ordering drugs over the internet through pharmacies and having it delivered here to Channel 5.
Wow. Right?
And you know, in the dressing rooms downstairs in my locker, I had lines of cocaine and OxyContin lined up. And I mean, I was a freaking mess. I was a mess. But there was never any mention of that. They just, you know, kind of kindly ever, and quietly let me go.
Nobody ever confronted
right?
you
nobody
about
ever
that?
Nobody ever confronted me about it, at least not that I can remember. And it's possible they did and I didn't know because I was so wasted. But, you know, it was wild because that was during the Olympics, and we have, you know, Bob Costas in the building, and I'm back in the locker room or in the dressing room doing lines of coke and OxyContin just to get right. You know, I'm not getting high at that point. I'm just getting straight. And so eventually I end up back in treatment in 2002 and discovered something very, for me, important in my recovery today. And what I discovered was the people that had stayed sober, I'd gone to that treatment center 10 years prior to that in 92
mm-hmm.
and got sober for 8 years, got the job at Channel 5. Life was good. And then I go through this relapse. So aside from the resentment, which I touched on already, understanding how critical that is not to have that in your life. They say, you know, resentment, the way that it affects us, especially as alcoholics and addicts. For me, I recognize today that God, this light in my life is that's what keeps me sober. I'm not capable of not drinking. I'm not. But God does that for me every day. So if I lose God, then I'm doomed. Like, because if I'm left to my own means, I'm going to drink again. I'm going to use again. And with resentment, it says, when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the spirit and we drink again. And for us to drink is to die. This is what Bill W. wrote in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous and just beautifully scripted. And so I get back to treatment and I realize the importance of, like, dude, you can't be picking up resentments. Like, you got to have an outlet to let that go. And then secondly, the thing that I discovered, the guys that were still there that were sober, and there was, you know, more than a handful of them, and it was a large facility that I had gone through in Hawaii, and they continued to work with other alcoholics and addicts.
And the community.
The community, whether they were the chair of their AA, you know, their chapter, or you know, some of them were counselors, you know, had gone back and become counselors, or they were working, you know, as coaches, you know, addiction coaches, or working on the facility. And I recognized at that point, like, that was the biggest difference. I thought I was active in church. I was like the Elders Quorum president. I was that kind of stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, okay, yeah, I'm doing the spiritual thing, but I wasn't. You know, I wasn't really connecting the way I needed to with the community and carrying the message of recovery. So I made that commitment in 2002 when I went through and got sober again that, you know, this time around, I'm going to carry the message. And for the most part, I've done that. And I've had relapses between then and now. And they've been mostly the times when it's been like I let go of that part of what I'm doing. And I think, okay, I don't need to do that right now. I'm too busy to do that. And I'm recognizing the importance of it. And understanding that I can't afford to let that go.
You're listening to Project Recovery. We're listening to Alema Harrington, and he's talking about his journey through addiction and beyond. And we're going to be back in just a few seconds because I want to find out your keys to letting resentment go.
Do 2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
She was tear-gassed and beaten.
Images of thousands desperate to escape Taliban oppression filled our news feeds. More than 80,000 Afghans made it to America. But the story didn't end there.
It was very cold. There was no power, no heat.
Who would help our newest neighbors? I'm Andrea Smartin. In Stranger Becomes Neighbor, you'll hear the stories of some remarkable refugees who left their homes and their dreams behind, only to start over from zero.
Their only possession was 3 blankets.
And you'll meet Americans who stepped up to help them.
You want me to come when you deliver your baby.
What can one person do in the face of an international disaster decades in the making? That's Stranger Becomes Neighbor. Find us at kslpodcast.com. Follow us on Apple Podcasts or anywhere else you listen.
You know that what, for me, I think I've got a lot of resentment, and still I haven't processed a lot of that information because, to be honest with you, Dr. Matt, I just don't know if I'm ready right now for it, and I don't know if it's something that you need to rush into. But it sounds like, you know, through all your stories, you know, losing a wife, you know, kids, and you said you were open to talk about this. I mean, how do you let go of some of these resentments? Is it a process? Is it a?
You know, the interesting thing for me is you look at the 12-step program, let's say, and Dr. Matt, and, you know, clients that you will work with, you know, patients that come in. It is a step at a time process is something you work toward. You can't get over the resentment just by saying, oh, you know, I'm over it. Because how many times you hear somebody like, you know, talk about something that they were upset about, but I'm over it now. I'm over it.
Yeah.
And it's just, so obvious that words. They're not.
Right.
Yeah. And so you can't get over it by just saying that I'm over it.
Well, and there's a difference between knowledge and insight. And so a lot of times people will say what they know they need to say, like, oh, I'm over it. I don't want to be resentful. Right. But they haven't really deepened their understanding of who they are and that situation and the other relationships and really developed an insight, which is powerful, and then you can let it go. But it is definitely a process, and it's hard, and I think that's why most people avoid doing it.
Here's one of the things, Casey, that was helpful for me was, and I talked about this earlier today. I did group at our do this morning down in Provo, and talking with our clients about resentment and letting go and having, you know, how resentment is just like drugs and alcohol, you know.
It's an emotional poison.
I didn't use drugs and alcohol because it sucked. Like, I used drugs and alcohol because it worked. You know, people don't get resentful because it doesn't work. They do because it's soothing in some way. Like, it makes me and there's plenty of chemicals that are released in the process.
Anger.
That are intoxicating chemicals.
Absolutely.
So it's easy to become really addicted to just that anger. Resentment is this reoccurring, resilient type of anger. You know, when I talk about resentment, I use the example where I was talking to a guy and I was in treatment talking to the guy at breakfast and he sat down. He was so pissed. I'm like, dude, what's going on? He's like, man, that John, like, he was just going off about John. He's like, man, telling me this whole thing about what John had did. And I'm like, man, like, what are you going to do about it? So, there's nothing I can do about it. So, like John is sitting right there, dude. He's at the next table. And he's going, no, not that John. And it's like, well, what John are you talking about? I said, well, you don't know. I said, well, when did this happen? Like, yesterday when you were out on passing notes, this happened 3 years ago. I'm like, what? Right? But that's what resentment is to carry this emotion, right? Of like it just happened, and we become kind of like addicted to that. Like,
it's sort of an empowering feeling, right? Yeah.
So for me, it was realizing that I couldn't get over that just by, as you said, Dr. Matt, just saying, like, you know, I'm over it. It was a process, and then there was a recognition that came there, similar to my recognition with drugs and alcohol, was that I might not be capable of doing this on my own. Like, I might need some divine intervention for me. Like, the way I look at it today, like, forgiveness is not a human trait. That is a divine trait. And so for me to think, oh, I can get over it if I try harder. That would be like me saying, like, I can stop drinking if I try harder.
Oh, I tried.
Right?
Yeah.
So for me, it was understanding, okay, it might take that same type of approach for my resentment as it did for this alcohol and drugs that I was dealing with, which has been a 12-step process, and continues today. But if you look at where resentment is and getting past that anger and those things are, it's not step two. It doesn't, step eight and step nine is when you write down, you know, a list of people that you've harmed and become willing to make amends to them. And step four and five is where you look at the things that have happened in your life. But, you know, that's not in the there's a lot of spiritual work that has to be done to get to that point. At least that has been my experience. And so it's understanding, Casey, for me, it's like I might not be able to get over this on my own. Like, I might need God's help for this. And then that opens the door for a lot of, you know, solutions and power to start to flow through.
And that's the difference between trying harder and letting go.
Yeah.
Right? And so I think you have to stop trying harder in the ways we think of trying, and we have to take it down a new path, which is letting it go and being open to help and support. And that's, I think, when a person's able to do that, that's a real step in the right direction of gaining that insight.
Yeah, I'm guessing, you know, Casey, that you've experienced this too, is just that so many of the things that we do in recovery are counterintuitive.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And they tell you all the time, like, whatever your first thought is, don't do that.
But, you know, which is counterproductive, because my whole life, that's how I got to where I was, by taking that first thought. Yeah. People are like, that's crazy. And I go, okay, but it seemed to work out. You. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And the insanity of this disease, right, is that we started doing it because it was working. The insanity is that I'm still doing it, and it stopped working a long time ago.
You like, said what that the hell so beautifully. Yeah, because I kept thinking, what I'm still doing what I've always been doing, but it's not working anymore. Yeah. You know, and I remember seeing this thing with Samuel Jackson, and they says, when did you stop drinking? And he goes, when it wasn't working for me anymore. Yeah. You know, and I was like, wow. But the insanity was I kept doing the same thing, thinking that it was gonna all come back. But it didn't.
Somehow this time it's gonna be different.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, I think as human beings we have kind of this inborn tendency that if this amount of anything is good, then more of that thing is better.
Oh yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I think that accounts for half the troubles we have as human beings, is instead of doing the Sam Jackson thing and saying, hey, that's not working, I'm done, we're just like, well, I'll do it more.
Yeah.
And you can see how that, I mean, whatever our bad habits are, we keep going down that path, it gets worse and worse until we eventually realize we have to cut it off and let it go.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you said through your recovery, you've been to 10 different recovery centers.
Yeah.
And you even said that you've relapsed, you know, a time or two again.
Yeah.
Speak a little bit about the relapses, because I think in this state of Utah, a lot of people hear the word relapse and think that they've gone all the way back to where they were. But what is your experience with relapses?
And I'm glad you bring this up, because I don't get an opportunity necessarily to talk, you know, about this in a general forum as much as I would do, like, let's say with clients
at Ardu,
because relapse happens, right? It's like and when it happens, it's like, I remember as a counselor finally getting a different perspective on it when somebody relapsed, and I was like, okay. Whereas opposed to, like, when I relapse, it's like, oh my gosh, like, what am I doing? What have I done? It's like when it's realizing, like, we're dealing with the disease. Nobody gets mad at cancer patients when their cancer comes back, right? And nobody goes, like, you didn't chemo hard enough. It's like, that's your, like, what's wrong with you, right? But we do that all the time with people that deal with the disease of addiction. So for me, it's like any time that you know, I pick up anger and resentment, I let that fester, or the times when I just, you know, start to minimize and justify, which all happens when I'm letting go of my connection with divine, because that's where the power to overcome all of these, you know, these defects of character come from, is from that power that is given by God for me. And so, you know, for me, it's like slipping into, well, I think that maybe I can use a little bit, right? And fortunately for me today, I've been in, you know, the last major relapse I had was 7 years ago. And for me looking back on it, I thought maybe I can drink a little bit. You know, I was going through a rough time emotionally, and I thought I'd like I need some kind of relief, and I wasn't finding it, and I wasn't really exercising my program and looking for that solution in the spiritual sense. And so all of a sudden, the wild thing is that like alcohol made sense. Like I can drink a little bit. And so, you know, I drank a little bit. And I thought, wow, I drank a little bit and it was okay, right? Maybe I can drink some more. And this is the way the alcoholic and addicted brain works, right? It starts to justify. It's just trying to minimize it enough to get it back into your system. And then for, you know, as I understand the disease of addiction, that's when the chemical reaction happens in the body of the alcoholic and the addict. Once I put those chemicals in my body, it triggers my midbrain, my amygdala, and it fires up and it says, we need more of that or we're going to die. And then I lose agency. I lose control over where it goes from there. But I was fortunate enough to have enough understanding about the disease at that time and I had good people around me that I was able to get into a day treatment and I could go to outpatient therapy and get some help. And so I was able to do that, get back on track. Then, you know, had another slip, you know, and able to identify it immediately, sometimes not immediately, maybe after a week or two, it's like, okay, this is not working.
Yeah. Yeah.
But still having enough clarity to understand that, you know, I need to reach out for help. And that, to me, Casey, has been the key, one of the main messages that I try to share today. It's like, dude, if you relapse or if you've used, man, okay. But let's just deal with that. And I still can think of when I, you know, got sober thinking, I'm not going to tell anybody till I have 5 years again. Because I was embarrassed that I only had 6 months. Or I'm embarrassed that I only have 1 year. Right? And today I recognize what nonsense that is. There's still a part of my ego and pride that's like, ah, man, it hurts.
You're an athlete. I'm going to recover better than anybody.
Yeah, and I don't want anybody to know that I had, you know, a moment of weakness and failure. Like, what will people say? Like, they heard me speak about the power of recovery, and then I screw up. You know, it's like the Macklemore song, which is
starting
so
over,
freaking on point, man. I remember hearing that song, just
getting tears,
man.
He's singing what I'm thinking.
Oh my gosh, the power of that. You know, for those of us that have been there, and it's like, what do I do? Like, what do I do? And so. You know, part of the message is what you do is you reach out. Reach out to somebody. Talk to them. I have people in my life. Christian Smith, who's been on the show before, a good, great friend of mine.
Great LDS guy. Yeah. He swore the most on this podcast out of anybody.
Yeah.
He's got the record.
You
got to
love him. You
I was like, are you sure you're LDS?
You're classic LDS crack addict. It's the best. And so, you know, that was a breakthrough for me was having him in my life because he provided this kind of this space of safety, right, that I could reach out to him and be honest, because that's hard. You know, it's hard to be vulnerable and let down that wall and say, man, I'm struggling.
Well, don't you think that's because so many people out there, somebody like Christian would understand you,
yes.
But so many people out there have that preconceived notion of what an addict is. They don't understand that it's a disease. They're judgmental. Isn't that still? Don't you think that's why people are like, I don't want to let anybody know I'm struggling.
And there's still people to this day. I have people in my life that don't believe this is a disease, and think that that's a moral failure or a weakness or like you like
the try harder.
Yeah,
method.
It's like how could you?
Yeah.
Like, how could you go back and use again?
Oh, I've had that conversation with people.
And it's like, well, let me tell you how you could, right? There's still a lot of misunderstanding.
But we end up believing that ourselves, right? Like, don't you think people, like, that's what keeps you silent is because you're believing that message that's out there because that was what was pounded into everyone's head growing up.
Yeah.
And so it's not until you get out and you really start to explore the fact that, you know what, maybe I should talk about that relapse, because that's where I'm learning the most.
Yes.
Look at all the things I'm learning and the growth you get through having a relapse. Not that you seek a relapse for that, but when relapses happen, they're powerful and can move people in the right direction.
And I'll tell you, you know, being stuck in that space of having relapse and not telling anybody is the most probably, you know, it's torture. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the importance of honesty as it relates to, you know, period, but as it relates to this disease is, you know, if I can't be honest with myself, then where am I? And one of the important steps in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous is we admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. And really for a lot of us, for me, that might have been the first time that those three people knew that, you know, the other person and me being part of that group.
And most of the time, it's us being part of that group.
Yes.
Most everybody around us know or have an idea. But I remember the first time that I was honest with myself.
Yeah.
I remember when I was up at the detox at uni, and I had to come down and go to a 12-step meeting. And that was the first time. And I've never been to one. And it was my first time. I stood up, and I said, my name is Casey Scott, and I'm an alcoholic.
Yeah.
And it was probably one of the most freeing things. You know, everyone, my friends, my family, they all knew.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I wasn't very good at hiding it.
Everybody else had diagnosed you a long time ago.
You know,
right?
But for me to stand up and say it about myself, I mean, it was like, oh.
Yeah. It's huge. And for me, you know, one of the groups that I have the honor and pleasure of doing is a step one group. Step one is admitting they were powerless over alcohol or our lives become unmanageable. Most of that seems like that's pretty self-evident by the time you end up in treatment.
Yeah.
But the truth is that even, you know, for being in that first part of I'm still not willing to admit. You know, the big book says we have to fully concede to our innermost selves that we're – I mean, that's a lot of depth right there, to our innermost mm-hmm. selves that we were alcoholic.
Well, think about it. Right? You said it when you first went to that first rehab. You were sitting in there, and the lady who was doing 30, she was sick.
Yeah,
you're in the exact same class
as her.
I'm not
like that.
But you're not her. I'm not one of them.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's the part that many of us, I struggled with, and I witnessed this when guys are going through their step one, and I feel their pain because it's so hard, because I have to admit that I have done these things to my kids, right? And to me, I'm like, I can't be that guy. I can't be that guy. I don't care what I have to do. I cannot be that guy. And the truth is that I have to own that I'm that guy. And I watch guys go through that process. I'm like, please, man, just let it go and say I'm that guy, because none of us want to be that guy. But I'm that guy, Casey. I'm that freaking guy. And until I got there, then I was unable to really move past that. Oh, excuse me.
You're getting emotional. And that was the toughest thing for me. I've got three kids, and I had to admit that I was that guy. I'm not that guy now. I'm not that guy now. But I was that guy. And all I can do is just keep trying to be better each day. But I was that guy. And that was so hard for me to swallow. I was the guy on TV. I was the guy that everybody loved to see. But I was the guy that ruined it all.
Yeah.
That could have ended up in jail and have to see my kids graduate through bars.
Yeah. I was that guy. I was that guy.
But you're not that guy.
Not that guy today.
No.
You know, God willing, you know, I can continue that path and for any of us. And we're all vulnerable. We're all human. And you know, we have weakness and those things can happen. But as long as I can you know, continue to understand that, you know, that I'm not cured of this disease, right? I had a counselor tell me once to, you know, take your step one, that experience, right, and put it in your front pocket, pull it out, and remind yourself every day. Because life's going to get good, right?
Mm-hmm.
It does. I mean, you start living a sober life and a life, you know, with these program, the principles of this program, life just gets good. And it's real easy to forget that the things that I have done, it's like, maybe it wasn't that bad. And so the point that my counselor was making is, I want you to pull that, not for morbid, you know, reflection, not to say, man, I was such a piece of trash. It's like to look at it and say, man, this is what God brought me out of. And if I go back and let go of the program that I have, I'm right back there, you know. And that's the beauty of working with clients today is I can see them go through their step one. I'm like, whew, man, God, thank you. Thank you for where I am today, where you brought me today.
You're listening to Project Recovery, a podcast about addiction, more importantly, about recovery. Alema Harrington is sharing his story with us. In a few seconds, make sure you tune over to the next episode. We're going to find out what he's doing now and how he's giving back.
Of this program are for informational purposes only. The program is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician, licensed therapist, or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you've heard on this program. KSL does not recommend or endorse any specific tests, physicians, products, procedures, opinions, or other information that may be mentioned on the program. Reliance on any information provided on the program is solely at your own risk.